I've entitled this section of our course, From Euthanasia to Aid in Dying, in order to particularly highlight the attempts of the pro-euthanasia lobby to shift the whole concept of what euthanasia is to something that seems beneficial, kindly, and compassionate. The terminological shift from euthanasia to the idea of aid in dying is a particularly good example of this. As I've noted in the first section, and as we've already highlighted several times, I think it's important for us to constantly bear in mind that there is an essential distinction which the promoters of euthanasia seek to obscure or to deny. They would claim that physician-assisted suicide is no different from refusing disproportionate treatment, but this is not the consistent teaching of the Church, nor of the majority of medical associations or nursing associations in the United States. As the beginning of the text emphasizes, as we've noted, and particularly as we saw in the case of St. Alphonsus Liguori and those who came before and after him in the moral theological tradition, it's clear that in certain circumstances, Catholics may licitly refuse even life-prolonging treatments, and this is not the equivalent of suicide. The intention is not to die, but to avoid that which is experienced as burdensome or repugnant. The term horror vehemens, as you'll recall, is what tended to be used by moralists in St. Alphonsus' day. And this principle is reiterated, as we've seen, and as we'll see now again briefly, both in Jura et Bona, the document on euthanasia that we just studied, and in Evangelium Vitae as well. Recall from Jura et Bona, the section that's quoted here below, it's always permissible to make do with the normal means that medicine can offer, but one cannot impose on anyone the obligation to a technique which, even though it's in use, carries a risk or is burdensome, and this is not the same thing as suicide. There can be very legitimate reasons for refusing this kind of treatment, and we'll see them described specifically, explicitly, in Evangelium Vitae. And then again, a reminder that when inevitable death is imminent, one is permitted to refuse any kind of treatment that would do nothing but secure a precarious or burdensome prolongation of life. So especially as death draws near, people have the right to refuse anything they experience as burdensome, even if it has the potential of prolonging, well, in this case, prolonging the dying process, which the Church does not regard as a moral obligation. So let's look then at Evangelium Vitae, the later document from the Magisterium. There is a moral obligation to care for oneself and allow oneself to care to be cared for, but it has to be determined whether or not the treatment is proportionate or disproportionate. And so, highlighted here, to forego extraordinary or disproportionate means is not the equivalent of suicide or euthanasia. So, again, a very clear statement that one's intention counts very, very strongly. It's very, very important. It's the acceptance of the human condition in the face of death. Now, having said that, in number 15 of Evangelium Vitae, there is also the very clear statement that one must not misuse this principle of the right to refuse treatment as an excuse for not providing treatment to the disabled. And I've added in the red section is my own commentary on this text, the disabled must always receive compassionate treatment. And so in number 15, one is reminded that there is a temptation to euthanasia, to resolve the problem of suffering by eliminating it, that is to say, by hastening death. And this is specifically condemned. It's also pointed out a little further on the highlighted text, this is aggravated in a cultural climate that fails to perceive any meaning or value in suffering, but regards suffering as the epitome of evil. There's another danger. It's described in the black highlighted text as a certain Promethean attitude, that is to say, the notion of being able to control everything. All can be taken into the hands of science and a modern humanity. Nothing should be left to nature. This attitude that leads people to think that they can control life and death by taking decisions into their own hands. And what actually happens, as the document points out, is that in this case, the individual is overcome and crushed by a death deprived of any prospect of meaning or hope. So this Promethean sense of we'll be in charge, we'll take care of all suffering, we will end your life, is effectively saying your life, your suffering, has no meaning and there is no hope, which is precisely what the church denies. And euthanasia, then, it goes on to, is in the highlighted text, is sometimes justified by the utilitarian motive of avoiding costs. Here one might note, as we've mentioned before, the most expensive time of a person's life is the last 6 months of life. So if this time is shortened, then the government and the insurance companies and whoever else is paying for the care for this individual will serve to save lots of money. So there indeed is a utilitarian motive for avoiding costs that figures into the question of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, and there is specifically condemned the proposal to eliminate malformed babies, persons with a genetic or other kinds of defects, severely handicapped, disabled, or elderly and not self-sufficient persons, and especially the terminally ill. And there is also the very ominous but unfortunately accurate observation that there can be other inducements to euthanasia, and that is the relative lack of availability of organs for donation. Now, the tragedy, of course, in this case is that, generally speaking, organ donation is based on death, which usually means brain death, which would not be the case in the forms of euthanasia that are being described here, but as has been brought to the view of the public relatively recently, practices in China and elsewhere indicate that this Vatican document is not alarmist, but in fact was anticipating some of the real horrors that have begun to take place in our own day, as we'll discover later in this course. In section 2, I've highlighted again, and this is so important for us to bear in mind, that one of the tactics of those involved in promoting euthanasia is to deny that there is any distinction between physician-assisted suicide or withdrawing disproportionate therapy. And although I've given you, and I certainly want you to read, this excellent article by Ezekiel Emanuel, which is a very good historical and philosophical moral study of euthanasia over the last century and a half or so, there is one thing that he does, as we'll see, that is a little bit problematic. But before we get to that, the first point in the text that I make is that the supporters of euthanasia want to deny that it is in fact euthanasia. So even the term physician-assisted suicide is regarded as negative and offensive, and so there tends to be a shift towards calling this aid in dying, making it sound like it is a compassionate assistance rather than a manipulation of the individual. A good example of this is the most powerful lobby in favor of euthanasia, the Hemlock Society, which changed its name in 2003 to End of Life Choices, and then in 2004 it merged with a similar organization called Compassion in Dying, and the following year this new organization reinvented itself as Compassion and Choices. So here you see the progressive change, not in attitude or approach, but an attempt to make this approach more acceptable to society by the substitution of sweet-sounding euphemisms for the very obvious fact that this is encouragement of suicide and, in fact, the act of killing people. The second thing that is a part of the agenda of the pro-euthanasia lobby is denial of the moral distinction that we've mentioned between withdrawing disproportionate therapy and intentionally hastening or causing death. That is, they deny that the principle of double effect has any value or meaning, and that it is just a kind of a delusion that is used philosophically to rationalize a particular approach that they claim is irrational. Now, in the article that I've given you, Euthanasia, Historical, Ethical, and Empirical Perspectives, an otherwise excellent article, you can see that in his chart, at the very beginning of the article, there is a listing of various kinds of euthanasia, and unfortunately, and if you read the text, you'll see that he modifies this and adapts this very significantly, but unfortunately, in numbers 4 and 5, he describes terminating life-sustaining treatments, that is, withdrawing what might be disproportionate therapy, as passive euthanasia, And in number 5, he calls the administration of narcotics or other medications to relieve pain with the incidental or unintended consequence of hastening death. He calls this indirect euthanasia. Now, in fact, the church would deny that either of these actions are in fact euthanasia in any sense. And his attempt to create a consistent nomenclature, a way of describing these acts, unfortunately has been seized upon by promoters of euthanasia as implying the equivalence of these activities with euthanasia. Now, that was not the intention of Dr. Emanuel in his article. If you read the article, you'll find that he's an opponent of euthanasia, and he believes that numbers 4 and 5 are morally not only permissible, but traditional and very acceptable and right. But the existence of this chart and the terminology that it contains has been quoted, requoted, and used in a number of later documents, continues to be used by individuals who want to claim that the philosophical distinction between withdrawing or withholding disproportionate or burdensome therapy is the same thing as euthanasia. They want to deny that there's any distinction between that or the giving of medication to treat pain, which has the incidental effect of shortening life. Their claim would be that this is a form of euthanasia as well. Again, that was not Dr. Emanuel's intention, but this chart and the terminology that it describes has been used as a weapon in the pro-euthanasia lobby. If one then shifts down to number 3, euthanasia in Europe and in the USA, there are any number of studies now of euthanasia in Holland and in the Low Countries, in Belgium and in Luxembourg, and as well in this country, of Oregon in particular. The trouble is that these studies are inevitably connected with individuals with a very strong agenda. They are often difficult to interpret, as we've noted in other contexts about similar kinds of studies, and so contradictory results are often published. But various things are clear. The first is that within Belgium, and within Holland, and then also Belgium and Luxembourg, physician-assisted suicide exists. But not only physician-assisted suicide, but euthanasia as well. This has been legally available since 2002 in Holland, but it existed for some time before. This is largely non-prosecuting of euthanasia. There is a kind of an insistence that cases be reported to the government, but studies have consistently indicated that not all cases are reported and that there are incidents of individuals being euthanized without anyone giving any kind of consent, not the patient, who's often incapable, or even family members or relatives. And there are also instances of infants being euthanized in these contexts as well. That's undeniable. The statistics clearly describe it. It tends to be obscured intentionally by the supporters of this practice. Another very controversial issue is the practice of euthanasia in Switzerland, where individuals are permitted to travel to Switzerland in order to be assisted to die, and this is something that we'll look at in just a couple of minutes. Now, the question of Oregon and the interpretation of what has been going on there is, again, rather obscure. One is still awaiting definitive and clear studies of this. But what is clear and has been documented over and over again is that there is a consistent failure to take into consideration the presence of depression in individuals who are requesting euthanasia. And here one has the fundamental, if you will, not just philosophical, but psychiatric question: is not the request for suicide itself evidence of psychopathology? If one looks at the diagnostic and statistical manual, suicidal ideation, thinking about suicide, or suicide attempts are one of the major indications of a major affective disorder, an indication that the person is not rational. So the importance of determining whether or not depression is present, whether or not it is present and when it could be treated, is important, and yet it has been clear clearly documented that individuals in the state of Oregon have been allowed to have been provided with the means of committing suicide and have done so without being fully or adequately assessed and certainly not being treated for depression. So there are some very controversial issues in this, and involved also is the legal question, should not a depressed person be allowed to commit suicide? Why should depression cause a person to lose their autonomy? So, effectively, one has this terrible conundrum of individuals who want to promote euthanasia, wanting to discount or eliminate the category of depression as significant, and the psychiatric community saying, well, wait a moment, the desire to die is very clearly an expression of psychopathology. If someone comes into the emergency room having attempted suicide, we do not assist them, we treat whatever it is that they've done to themselves, and then we psychologically evaluate them and we try to treat them for the condition that caused them to try to request suicide. So there is an essential contradiction in this whole project that is obscured and is of particular concern to members of the health professions who are involved in treating mental illness, but also to those in palliative care, because as we shall see, it is precisely the physicians and nurses and other professionals involved in palliative care, that is providing pain treatment without attempting to treat the disease, which is so important, particularly at the end of life, these are the most reluctant to go along with any notion that euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide is appropriate. Nevertheless, palliative care is, in some contexts, described as a form of euthanasia, and this properly upsets and causes violent opposition on the part of individuals providing this kind of care. The efforts on the part of the pro-euthanasia lobby to attempt to pass that kind of legislation in states is ongoing, as I'm sure we're all aware from the recent election. And here, as in so many other matters, as long as the issue is framed in terms of individual rights and the oppression or denial of those rights, the matter will be very controversial, and you will find people supporting it who don't really think about what the issues involved truly are. Notice also, and I've highlighted, that in Canada there was a ruling in mid-2012 that persons who cannot commit suicide themselves are disadvantaged by the laws that exist and that prevent assisted death practices from occurring openly. So there is this horrible creeping tendency to describe people who cannot themselves commit suicide as disadvantaged and the need of assistance from others. So there is a progressive tendency within this movement for suicide or euthanasia as an individual right to eventually push it into a point of being compulsory for individuals who are not able to, quote, exercise that right, unquote. And finally, as the last part of this webpage, I've included an interview that was offered in 2008 between a Swiss news service, Swiss Info, and Dr. Jerome Sobel, who is the president of EXIT, a pro-euthanasia organization that facilitates assisted suicide, and in it he describes his work. And I'd invite you to take a look at this. I hope you find it as repugnant as I do. The assistants who are volunteers, who basically provide the poison that the individual is invited to drink, and the requirement that the individual be able to drink it themselves, because therefore this is assisted suicide and not technically euthanasia, according to the proponents of this approach. And many people wonder what is actually done in and by institutions like this. Well, Dr. Sobel is more than willing to discuss this, and there is a link at the bottom if you wish to look at the entire interview in its totality.